ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர்க், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் நீட் ஃபார் ரிலீஜியன் அண்ட் ஃபவுண்டேஷன் ஆஃப் பக்தி, பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க்யூ. ஓம் நம சிவாய.
There's another reason. And it also happens to be one of Chalapaswami's Mahavakyam. Nam Ariyom. We do not know. That sounds strange. We do not know. Usually you say we know. The goal is to know something. But he's saying we do not know. Giving us an opposite statement. So I was thinking about that, trying to figure out what kind of illustration to give. So it would be like asking one of our acharyas, Acharya, you've been studying with Gurudeva now for 30, 35 years. What have you learned? And the acharya says, I've learned that I do not know. So, what does that mean? It means that the deepest spiritual experiences transcend the intellect. Intellect deals in memory and reason. Memory and reason are very useful, but they're not useful when it comes to deeper experiences. So, to go beyond memory and reason, we have to give them up. We have to have the feeling we do not know, which is also called deep humility. The feeling that we know a lot is also called ego. I'm the smartest person here. That's the ego speaking. So, Chalapaswami says we have to go beyond that. We have to reduce the sense of ego, reduce the sense of intellectual knowledge, so that we really feel we don't know. Meaning the external mind doesn't know. We have to go deep enough to experience it. So that's also one of the beauties of the foundation of devotion, is it helps us end up in that state of mind. People with a very strong ego sense who don't have devotion, they go into the temple and you can tell by their body language something's wrong, you know, standing in the back like that, not participating in the worship at all, not really understanding what's going on, because they're in their intellect, they're in their ego sense. It doesn't make sense to them. It doesn't seem like something they want to participate in. It seems beneath them, whatever. They don't relate to it, and you can tell by how they stand, by how they move. So there's a wonderful chapter in Living with Shiva on surrender, prapati, which catches the essence of what we're talking about here, that we have to, through devotion, learn to surrender. We have to learn to acknowledge the Mahadeva, who is greater than we are, and strive to experience his blessings. So of course, we start first with Ganesha. So we've all done that. We've all experienced Ganesha's blessings by surrendering the ego to something greater. By saying, Ganesha, you are great. Please let me experience your blessings, your Shakti. And we open ourselves to that. It's prapati. And it softens the ego. That's the beautiful phrase Gurudeva uses, softens the ego. Makes us a less egoistic person. We're not so self-centered. We don't think ourselves so great. We also don't want to think ourselves little. That's not the point. That's a negative ego. We just want to think of ourselves as a soul, and that there are certainly greater beings than we are spiritually. The Mahadevas are so much greater than we are. And we have a sense of genuine humility because we're identifying with our soul nature. So that's the second benefit of a religious practice. And in our tradition, Charya Kriya Yoga Yana, Kriya being the intense awakening of devotion, precedes yoga. Kriya precedes yoga. So devotion precedes deep meditation. We don't try and encourage someone to meditate deeply until they're deeply devoted. So first, you're deeply devoted. Secondly, you learn to meditate deeply. It's not that we discourage simple meditation. Meditation is good for anyone. It helps you center yourself, quiet your thoughts, so forth. But intense meditation or deep meditation isn't encouraged or doesn't bear fruit until it's preceded by deep devotion. Got a third reason that Gurudeva focused so much on the temple and religion. Each religion has a hierarchy of saints, angels, and archangels which assist all of its followers from the inner planes, helping them through their difficult times, answering their prayers and supplications. When we leave the fold of religion, we remove ourselves from the benign influence of these great beings and actually open ourselves to much lesser, base influences which can disrupt our lives. Spiritual life, especially as one progresses into the stages of mystical experience, is a very delicate process. Powerful forces are awakened in us that we may or may not always be able to perfectly control. So, there's a lot of help available on the inner planes, and it's very useful. But it's only there for those who are actually members of the religion. That's why Gurudeva had those of us in the West formally enter Hinduism, and why he encourages everyone to participate in a traditional religion. Doesn't favor New Age activity that's devoid of religious affiliation for this reason. There's no inner plane hierarchy there to help you out. You're outside of it. So when non-Hindus participate in Hindu activities, they're not fully attuned to this inner world. They haven't been accepted into the inner world. Like looking at the activity through a glass window. They're not fully able to participate in it. They can enjoy it to a certain extent, but they're not able to go into it as far as someone who's in the religion is. So it's a difference. And you don't want to be on the outside of the window looking through it into the room. You know, you want to be in the room, right? It's much more enjoyable. So for all of those reasons, Gurudeva focused on religious foundation and the importance of religion and placing the Vedantic truths in the Hindu religion, so that first we are of the religion, then we develop deep devotion, and then we can think about deep meditation, which of course eventually leads to realization. Wonderful, some wonderful statements by Yoga Swami, which I'll read in closing, on this idea of we do not know. When you have reduced yourself to nothing, when your small self has disappeared, when you have become nothing, then you are yourself God. The man who is nothing knows God, for God is nothing. Nothing is everything. Because I am nothing, you see, because I am a beggar, I am everything. So nothing means everything. Understand. It means that you genuinely desire nothing. It means that you can honestly say that you know nothing. It also means you are not interested in doing anything about this state of nothingness. You think you know, but in fact, you are ignorant. When you see that you know nothing about yourself, then you are yourself God. We're dreaming that we're not Parshiva, that we're going to realize Parshiva sometime in the future. But realizing Parshiva is like waking up. We say, oh, you know, I was already Parshiva. I was just dreaming that I wasn't. So it's like that. We just have to claim it. We have to step beyond time and space, step out of the concept that we have to do something, then something else, and then something else in order to realize it. Just like when we're traveling in a dream, you just have to wake up. Very simple, and we find we're home. Those are the interesting Tamil word, vidu, which means both home and liberation for some reason. Same word. It's unusual for a word to mean liberation and also home. So you're going along and you're reading something and it says vidu and you say, what are they talking about a house for? You know, no, that doesn't mean house. It's liberation in that sense. So it works perfectly with this analogy because in both cases, we end up vidu. We end up home or liberated. It's the same thing. So that's our monism. As Gurudeva says, sometimes we close our eyes and we're monists. Open our eyes and see us. So in this case, we're moving on to lesson 315 from Living with Shiva. I urge all Saivites, devotees of God Shiva, to worship him as the God of love, and in doing so, to become beings of love. The great saints of our religion were Shiva Bhaktars. They changed the world through their love of God Shiva. Sounds like theism, right? We have switched to theism. So the phrase that struck me, I mean, of course, the idea of loving God Shiva, we say that all the time, but the phrase that struck me this morning as I read this was, okay, step one, we're back in time and space, so things do work one step after another. Step one, we worship God Shiva. Step two, we develop a love of God Shiva. And what happens in step three? We become beings of love. So that's a very interesting idea. I've never realized that phrase was used before. Become beings of love. So, relates to our next subject. Holding the family together can be summed up in one word. Anybody care to guess? Love. Right, yes, love. There it is. Love. Love is understanding. Love is acceptance. Love is making somebody feel good about his experience. Love is giving the assurance that there is no need to keep secrets, no matter what has happened. Love is wanting to be with members of the family. So, being a being of love, as we all are, as we're all trying to be, seems the natural place to perfect that is in the family. The whole family unit, in our case we have a monastic family too, counts as a family. Holding the family together is summed up in the one word, love. So that's a wonderful topic, I think, to develop in the future. You know, what does it mean to be a being of love? You know, what's the yardstick? How can we measure how successfully we're being a being of love? Like last talk, we had a very wonderful yardstick given by Gurudeva on speech. You know, has to be true, kind, helpful, and necessary. Very easy to tell if we're following that or not. So maybe if we look in Gurudeva's teachings, we can come up with the equivalent of that to see how well we're being a being of love. Because it's an important part of our Saiva Siddhanta. Very important part. So looking at today's lesson, interesting combination of topics. Starts out on Lord Ganesha. Lord Ganesha, the god of time and memory, strategically seated on the Muladhara chakra, poised between the higher and lower chakras, stabilizes all sentient beings. So, I think the key word there is stability. We all want to be stable, have our lives go along smoothly without extreme ups and downs, either emotional or intellectual or financial or whatever. We want stability. So Lord Ganesha helps that occur in our lives. And one of the reasons is he keeps us from falling lower than the Muladhara chakra, falling into fear or anger. It's usually as low as anyone we know goes. Don't get down to the bottom. We don't know people that go around killing people for enjoyment. It's just the bottom. So usually people just go down into fear or anger. And he prevents that by being there and catching us. So one of the reasons many years ago Gurudeva felt that the practice of devotion and the worship of Lord Ganesha was important because he noticed instability in those he was teaching meditation to without a foundation of bhakti. They'd be soaring along in these wonderful states of mind, and then a few weeks later, they're in these terrible states of fear and doubt and can't even remember the beautiful inner states they had. You try and remind them and say, oh, remember last 2 weeks ago you had these beautiful inner light experiences? And they say, no, I didn't. I didn't do that. No stability. So up and down in consciousness all over the place. One of the problems with drugs is that it makes that kind of experience worse. You go way up, and then on the reaction, you go way down. So we want stability. We want to stay above these lower states of mind, stay above these extreme fluctuations. So Lord Ganesha helps that, and his worship helps that, and to be more specific, not just his existence, but worshiping him in a sincere way helps us stay above these lower states of mind of fear and anger. Also helps us calm down any emotional states of mind we might be in. If we're upset emotionally about something, whatever it is, the worship of Lord Ganesha helps stabilize that. So thinking about Ganesha brought another idea to mind, which is that, of course, we always like to think about the highest realizations, the highest experiences, deep thoughts, our oneness with Shiva, inner light, high-minded principles, which is good. But we also need to think about our weaknesses, our flaws. Maybe we speak too abruptly. Maybe we get angry. Maybe we're impatient. We also need to think about our shortcomings and improving them. It's just not enough to think about the high-minded truths. We also have to work on the weak points. So it's like someone, Gurudeva used to talk about dancing, and you pay someone to correct you. You're wanting them to tell you what you're doing wrong. You're wanting them to point out your weak point. You don't want them to sit there and praise you for everything you're doing right. You don't want them to say, oh, you're the best dancer I've ever had. No, you're paying the money and you don't want to hear that. You want to hear, you're doing this wrong, and this wrong, and this is how you can improve it. So, to move forward, once you get up to a certain standard, someone has to point out your weak points, or you have to point them out to yourself and decide to improve them. So the spiritual path is just like dancing in that regard, as Gurudeva mentioned on many occasions. So Lord Ganesha can help us see our weak points and improve them. Maybe our weak point is something as simple as we tend to create inharmonious conditions, tend to stir things up. Why? Well, we're kind of bored inside, and when things are stirred up, it's more interesting. Lots of people live in that state of mind. It's just kind of, if everything's quiet and peaceful and sublime, it's boring because they don't have an inner life. So they stir it up a little bit on the outside, keep things interesting, and keep from getting bored. So harmony is very important. And the first Shakti of Lord Ganesha, of course, is harmony in the home, and monastery is a home. So maintaining harmony is the foundation or the first step. If we don't have harmony in the home, if we don't have harmony in the monastery, forget about anything more. You can't build upon inharmonious conditions and create something more refined. It's not possible. So the worship of Lord Ganesha always reminds us of the first Shakti, the five Shaktis, the first of which is harmony in the home, and how central that is to all our spiritual endeavors, and how valuable it is. There's nothing more valuable than harmony in the home. It's priceless, because without it, nothing else really works right. All our other activities tend to be significantly inhibited when we don't have harmony in the home. Bless Lord Ganesha. Living with Shiva. Monastics are the religious leaders of Hinduism. Continuing this noble renunciate monastic tradition is essential for the perpetuation of the faith. Therefore, when a young boy expresses a desire to become a monk, parents should never discourage that inclination, but strongly encourage it in all ways. It is a great blessing for the family to have a son become a sannyasin. Goes on about that. So, you can't put a classified in the newspaper, monks wanted. It's more subtle than that. But monks are wanted, definitely. Did a calculation the other day and calculated we need to bring in a new monk every 2 years, just to keep the monastery the same size. So monks are wanted. If any family wants to conceive and raise a monk, we encourage it. Of course, you can't raise a monk if you haven't conceived a monk. So it's important to think about it first. A wonderful story. Swami Vivekananda, before he was conceived, his mother for a long time had a vrata every Monday. I think she went to the Shiva temple and worshipped for a son, a special son. And then he was conceived. So, you know, she thought about it well in advance. So that's the advice Gurudeva gives also in living with Shiva, that if you're thinking about raising a son for the monastery, think about it before conceiving the child, and not afterwards. Think about before conceiving the child and worship and pray and have that in mind when the child is conceived. And then it's much more likely when it's approached that way that you'll actually raise a son who ends up in the monastery. It's not enough for the parents to want the son in the monastery. The son also has to want to be in the monastery. Otherwise it doesn't work out right. So we have an invisible want ad. Monks want it, apply here. The next one, maturing the soul body. It's a really nice, tangible way to think about spiritual unfoldment. I'm spiritually unfolding, I'm spiritually advancing. What does that mean? So the idea of maturing the soul body gives us something tangible to think about. Spiritual unfoldment, advancing spiritually, means our soul body is maturing. We know what it means for a physical body to mature. So the soul body, in the same way, matures, meaning it develops. It becomes stronger. It's like a light that becomes brighter. A light that becomes more cohesively tied together. Emotional body is a good comparison, because the physical body, the way it matures, it gets old. So that doesn't quite work when you think about the soul body, because the soul body doesn't get old in the same way as the physical body does. When the soul body gets old, it gets even better. So the emotional body is a good comparison. So when we're very young, of course, we cry. You know, our emotions are such that almost everything sets us off to crying. And so we need to be protected by the parents. But as parents know, as the child gets older, crying becomes less. And the child is able to handle more difficult situations and doesn't have to run to mother as often and so forth. And the child gets up to a certain age and doesn't cry unless something serious happens. So that's an example of one of our bodies, in this case the emotional body, maturing. We get better control over it. So the soul body is the same way, a body of light that we get better control of. We're able to use it in a more controlled way. It doesn't react the way it does when it's young. It's like out of focus television set that you gradually focus, so the image becomes sharp. That would be like maturing the soul body. So it starts out kind of out of focus, not a sharp image, and it becomes more and more focused until it's a really well-defined image. So that's the idea of maturing the soul body. And it's what moves from life to life. So it doesn't go away, because that's who we really are. Everything else goes away around it eventually, or comes and goes, like the physical body. We take on a physical body, we drop it off, we take one on, we drop it off. You can't drop off the soul body, because that's who you really are. What surrounds it comes and goes, eventually drops off, but that's always there. You have to go into final merger in order for that to not be there anymore, which means you're really mature when you get to that point. So that's the real us. That's what spiritually unfolds, and that's what we take from life to life, and that's our real wealth. Can't take money with you. Can't take ideas with you. The one thing you can take from life to life is the maturity of your soul body. So when all is said and done, you know, how much have you advanced your soul body? That's the real bottom line of any life, because that's the only thing you take that's permanent from one life to the next. All other things end up dropping off, so that means it's valuable, because it's the real you. So that's what's worth investing in, the maturity of your soul body.